RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Julius Ruchel is an author and essayist, and recently, after returning from a 2-year writing marathon, which he described as his deepest deep dive, Julius announced the release of his latest book, Plunderers of the Earth. Julius is used to speaking out against the narrative we are given. He was on a WFF webinar back in 2021 discussing a famous essay he wrote, The Emperor Has No Clothes, Finding the Courage to Break the Spell, began, "To all the silent people watching our society tear itself in two, this essay is for you." It's my great pleasure to welcome Julius onto RCR this morning. Julius, nice to meet you. It's amazing that we can talk so clearly and so immediately across really the, you're the other side of the planet.
Yes, it's wonderful. Thanks so much for having me.
What are the good things?
You bet.
Out of many, not so good. Yeah. I want to get to Plunderers of the Earth. But first of all, I want to kind of zero in on Emperor Has No Clothes. And I'm wondering how far we've come since then at calling out, well, BS. Is the human race making progress against the corrupt system that gave us that pandemic, do you think?
Well, that's the $64 million question, I think. I think on some levels there is an awakening happening, and at the same time the question is whether the laws are outpacing that reawakening.
Yeah. You're beaming in from Vancouver, Canada, the other side of the planet. We hear a lot about Canada. Can you tell us what Canada is right now?
Well, it's a mess that seems to be leading the path that so many countries are forging. I don't know. It's hard to describe just how every single institution is crumbling away beneath our feet, with scientific institutions kind of leading the way.
And why do you think that is? Because that's so anti-science.
I think there's a point where, because we centralized so much power in the hands of a few institutions, that the funding ends up, corrupting the ability for people to think freely within these institutions. I mean, we saw the same thing during COVID, that so many scientists, like, I was shocked at first, like, why are there no doctors during the COVID era speaking out? And yet in reality, when there's so many gatekeepers above them in the hierarchy, and, unlike a career in something where you're working with your hands, a single, speaking out in one way against something that is now a popular narrative essentially destroys an entire career and prevents you from ever being hired by any other institution, because they are so globally interconnected. So that freedom, like, this is something that I think that people miss about the scientific institutions, is that you can't have a central gatekeeper and think that you have freedom of speech. The only way that academia actually is able to acquire knowledge is if there's many completely independent institutions competing for space in that public forum. And through that competition, even if everybody is corrupt, it's that contrast between different messages that starts to allow truth to boil to the surface and expose where there's mistakes being made or where there's corruption that's crept in. And so I think that this idea that we've connected, the big state is now being, advised by big institutions, which they themselves fund, it's turned into that, that cliche meme of, 97% of scientists agree with whoever is funding them.
Yeah. Yeah. And the question that a lot of people have regarding this is that the way that the progression of a system, or is this an opportunistic use of a system that has progressed in a certain way? Do you know what I'm asking there?
Yeah, I think I understand what you mean. I think that all systems, as they centralize, go down this path. Hmm. And I think that the cultural immunity towards that decentralization, once that breaks down, once there's an appetite for a big government to kind of serve as an anti-state, then this sort of process is essentially inevitable.
Climate might be a great example of that. I'm just reading a quote here, a selected quote, Julius, from one of your ex-posts. "When you boil it down to its bare essentials, the illusion of a global climate crisis is merely a fresh face for the same old game that plays out across the span of civilizational history. Predation by the few upon the resources and autonomy of the many." Here we go. Power, money, control. It's age old. Age old, right?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, okay. And that's the corruption then. That's inherently corrupt, isn't it?
Well, I think that there's the other part of this is that, you know, there are beliefs that emerge within any scientific institution that are wrong, and it's fine that they're wrong. But the problem is that if that belief becomes useful in a political sphere, it embeds itself. It becomes essentially like it takes on a life of its own that grows up beyond what is the normal chaotic process of, you know, ideas competing with each other in academia. And I mean, one of the examples that I brought up in my book was from the Dust Bowl in the 1930s in America, where this idea emerged as the settlers were moving west, that they noticed that the rainfall was increasing. And so this idea emerged that the rain follows the plow, that by breaking the sod, that the soil would be able to absorb more rainfall, which would, you know, capture the humidity instead of having it wash away as runoff. And so that would increase the rainfall. And for a while, it seemed like that conclusion was correct. And yet in reality, it was just a coincidence that there's these long-term climate cycles that were happening and the region was entering a wet phase. And so once that idea got embedded, it then morphed into this nation building exercise, what Plato called the noble lie. It's this exercise for nation building. And in that case, America was essentially using that to achieve its geopolitical aims of getting the entire continent settled in order to keep other rival nations, Spain, England, France, from grabbing a toehold. And so, and then of course the entire society jumped on it because it kind of reflected all the hopes and dreams of that era, this idea that, you know, through science, you could solve anything, and that, you know, there's this great frontier in the West, and through hard work and following the right scientific recommendations that they could actually make the desert bloom. And so it's sort of, then all of society throws itself behind that idea. And anybody that, you know, stands up to say, no, this is wrong, is the Debbie Downer that gets laughed straight out of the out of the public forum.
You're reminding me of that Eagles song, The Last Resort. I don't know if you know that, but
no.
Hotel California. It's kind of about that. So the modern equivalent of that is CO2, is it?
Very much so.
And climate change through CO2. That's been seized upon. Why? Because you make a whole lot of other points as to why there might be climate change going on.
Yeah.
And CO2 is not at the top of your list.
No, not at all. I think that this whole idea that, you know, CO2 is the control knob on the climate. Like it's this cover story for this sense of global crisis that requires global institutions, global cooperation, and in the end, a global centralization of power at the expense of local and individual of local communities and even individuals. Right. So, I lost my train of thought there.
Yeah, centralized versus local power, local individuals who know where they live and they can see things with their eyes, right?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the big points that emerges out of this book is that as long as we believe or view everything through this lens of CO2, all of these other local crises become invisible or are misdiagnosed because we can't see the solutions that are actually local and that also the causes for, you know, a drying area and all of these other, you know, local deteriorations. We can't see what's actually causing them because we're blaming the wrong thing. And I mean, this is where, you know, sort of reflecting back on what happened in the on the Great Plains, that through the soil erosion and by stripping off the sod in that era, what it actually did is created, took the ecosystem that was actually completely capable of withstanding these natural climate cycles and turned it into an extremely brittle environment that as soon as the rainfall reduced in the next dry cycle, everything falls apart. And that's something that, you know, we're seeing in lots of places now where it's not that the rainfall has gone down, it's that the ecosystem itself has been stripped of its natural defenses. And I mean, so all of a sudden the entire, you know, Sahel region in Africa falls apart as soon as there is a dry spell, even though that these droughts are not unprecedented in the longer view of geologic history.
Yeah, it's amazing missing the main point, isn't it? And I see that repeated in other things, for example, medical, diabetes, you know, insulin resistance causes diabetes, too much sugar, too many carbohydrates cause diabetes, but we won't look at that. What we'll do is we'll put you on a machine, we'll never question you about your diet, we'll never educate you, we'll just bypass that, which is so obvious, forget it exists, and do the other thing. And kind of the same thing, same thinking. Is that a human way of thinking? Or again, is that determined by follow the money? What's in it for me?
I think both to some degree. I mean, we all tend to look for a simple, easy to understand explanation for things. And yet, whether it's the human body and viruses and all of these things, or whether we're talking about entire ecosystems, there's so many interconnected parts to all of these processes. And if you try to reduce it down to one lens, through one lens, there may be some truth to that one lens, and yet it's being lost, like it's irrelevant in the bigger context. One of the big grazing management professors from Texas A&M, he talks about this, how, you know, the soil scientists will go out and stake out a 1 meter by 1 meter square of soil and study the living daylights out of it. And there is real truth to what he is discovering within that 1 meter soil, but he's completely losing the bigger picture of how that fits into a larger ecosystem.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that process, part of that is, you know, comes through all the way that everything in our academia is split into more and more specialized fields. And then, of course, the funding of that also means that the incentives to challenge bigger, more complex narratives goes away. It's much easier to hyper-focus on that one thing.
Yeah, like what about the other 2 million square hectares or acres?
Very much so. Well, I mean, look at this, the CO2 story is a perfect example where it's like, yeah, it is a greenhouse gas, and yet it's the effect of it is so incredibly minuscule, it's virtually irrelevant compared to all the other enormously powerful driving factors that affect the climate, from water vapor to, you know, continental drift, cloud cover, solar cycles, like the list goes on and on. And when you actually put that together, it's such a complex story, and you can immediately see that there's no room for CO2 in that. It's unnecessary and incapable of making any of these great effects that are being claimed about it.
We hear about this consensus on climate. Is there one?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Even in my own experiences of connections with geologists and other people that work in the earth sciences, I think the consensus is that they're all terrified of speaking out. I think that's the
consensus.
Right? Yeah. I think that there are some people that genuinely believe it, but there is a huge number of people that don't. There's some climate letter that was put out a while back, and I think there was something like 54,000, various scientists that basically signed onto it to say there is no climate emergency. And yet they don't get the microphone, and often they don't speak out until after they retire, when their careers can no longer be threatened.
Yeah.
Like that, there's that physicist that just won a Nobel Peace Prize, Dr. John Clauser. And once he retired, he felt free to speak, and he's been speaking up about how cloud cover is one of the big driving forces that's just not included in any of the climate models. And by leaving that out, that's why CO2, like this theoretical feedback effect from CO2 is now, you know, being plugged in to fill that gap that actually is completely explained by cloud cover. He had to retire first to be able to speak that freely.
Yeah. He didn't so much need the money at that point, is
that's right.
What you're saying.
Well, I mean, I think if you spend an entire career and years working on building something up, is it worth the risk when nobody else stands beside you and you're a lone voice that speaks up? In the end, probably not. I don't know that I can blame them.
It's a tough question. One thing, again, our listeners will be aware of, we talk about this a lot, is it's okay to disagree with someone on the science, yeah, even if it's obvious that the science is flaky. But to be so aggressive towards people who might have another view is next level. And that is something that is becoming more and more obvious, that people are shot down, not with an argument, but with aggression, name calling. People would have careers destroyed just for making a comment. How do you think we've arrived at that? There's so much tension in it.
Very much so. I mean, I think that in some ways, even the parents have played a role in this, that they've allowed the schools to go down this path where science is taught more like a lecture of facts that you should know, rather than that it's a process that fundamentally requires freedom of speech and debate in order for any kind of truth to emerge from that process. And if that sense is missing in the greater public, then these kinds of games that are being played that you describe, people can get away with playing them.
Yeah, I mean, you hear climate denier sounds like Holocaust denier. It's at that level.
Yeah.
You know.
Very much so.
The strap line in your book, Plunderers of the Earth, The Erosion of Civilization, The Mad Crusade to Control the Climate. Do you think there is a move to try, you know, not just live with the climate, but now to actually control it, to usurp nature, put it like that?
I think it's a very appealing idea that plays very well with the people that fund academic and scientific institutions. And if you go back even into the late 1900s and early 20th century, there's already, you know, the big weather modification programs were taking off, and they basically sucked most of the funding out. I mean, the funding for these weather modification programs was almost as big as the nuclear programs for the Manhattan Project. Huge funds were poured into this. And meanwhile, the meteorologists are on the sidelines going, well, you know, wait, this is silly. Like, how can you expect to make it rain if we don't even understand the processes that lead to rainfall happening? So I think that I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. Is, in your understanding, and this will clear something up maybe, is there weather modification going on right now? Because that seems to be an awkward debate, let's say, and, you know, conspiracy theories and all of that. But as far as you're aware, is that going on?
There are still some programs that are happening. I don't know to what degree they're effective versus being effective at gaining funding. I mean, a lot of these things were canceled in America in the 1970s because the main conclusion was that you ended up with rain only if it was going to be raining in the area anyways. They did have some success with getting rid of fog. But at the same time, there was a million legal liabilities and uncertainty as to whether, you know, if you are successful in pulling rain down in one place, the neighbor's going to sue your pants off because you stole his rain, right? So it's just a legal nightmare that is unresolvable.
And that also moves into genetics as well, GMOs, genetic modification, genetic engineering, CRISPR editing. Again, it's this motivation to control nature. Control everything.
Very much so. I think it's easy to sell a solution. It's not so easy to sell understanding about complex systems and how to harness them, right? And I think we are all to some degree guilty of falling for the shiny solutions rather than to, you know, step back and try to figure out how to actually work with the natural processes that are out there rather than trying to overcome them with a technological blip.
In your assessment, how far does this go before we get to some solutions that actually work and wind things, well, back, I suppose, or have the positive outcomes for climate, for health, all those things that we would all want? And I take it you would say that includes reversing centralization. So how far up the creek without the paddle, as we'd say, are we? And how can we come back, do you think? Can you give us sort of your vision on how that could happen?
On the political end of it, I'm somewhat pessimistic that there's going to be a great shift in any quick direction that comes through public opinion. I think the shift happens more that from the ground level up, that people on their own initiative or as communities start to implement solutions wherever they can that essentially provides an alternative explanation to all of these things. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with Alan Savory from Holistic Management.
No, I'm not.
He's an ecologist and farmer from Zimbabwe, who was actually working with the government at the time when they were looking at the elephants were tearing apart all of these ecosystems, and so him and a bunch of his peers decided there was too many elephants and they destroyed over 40,000 of them. And he recognized afterwards that the ecosystem was actually the deterioration sped up after all of these elephants were gone out of this dry environment, because now you don't have the central force that is essentially improving the grass as these big herds come through. And so from that he among others developed various, you know, rotational grazing systems that is designed to mimic these rotational or there are these migratory grazing herds that used to keep these ecosystems healthy. And I think that is kind of the model of where, you know, farmers, despite what some of the academics are saying, are adopting a lot of these practices and seeing impressive results. And so very slowly that, as that awareness grows, it eats away at all of these claims of that we need some technological solution, because all of a sudden somebody can see that, well, wow, this area has been, you know, repaired as a result of reintroducing large herds of livestock, but they're not scattered everywhere. They're actually mimicking the old migratory grazing behavior that previous herds had. And that changes minds far more than the politics does.
I'm thinking back to that example you gave about analyzing a square meter of soil. And the focus is too myopic, isn't it? You need to understand the interrelationships and admit this is almost complexity beyond our
very
understanding.
Much so.
Really.
I mean, this is one thing that when you're actually get your hands dirty managing the land, you're very quickly humbled at how little you actually understand of all of these complex interactions between things that each in their isolation, if you look at them in a lab, you think you understand the world, and then you place it out there with everything else that's going on and you realize you know nothing, you know?
Yeah. And that is humbling.
Very much so.
Always humbling. Yeah. So a move back to, we had the Polyfarm people on here. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
And
Joel Salatin, right?
Yeah, that's right. And wow, what a guy to talk to. And what struck me about that, and our listeners too, because we had plenty of feedback on that, was first of all, the clear thinking, very clear thinking. But in talking about complex system, the simplicity of operating it was also obvious.
Very much so.
To us. You know, it wasn't rocket science. It was quite simple, even though you are tuning or making the best of a complex system.
Very much so. Yeah, and I find it's been interesting to see that as various academics have taken up that banner. I mean, they are, you know, lone voices within their institutions, but we're seeing more and more that even their research is now clearly backing up what people like Joel Salatin or Alan Savory have been saying for decades. I mean, Dr. Tige that I mentioned earlier, in some of his work, he was showing how, like, on average, once you have like a high intensity mob grazing or rotational grazing system, you're depositing carbon in the soil at the rate of 8.6 tons per acre per year. I mean, these are colossal amounts of soil. Like, it's a soil building process. And yet that same herd of cows spread across the landscape that's not migrating, it will destroy that same patch of grass in a matter of a couple of years.
Wow. Yeah. Going to another level now. Do you think any of what we are living through now, and I know I get it that these are cycles and, you know, this is the modern version of it with our technological capabilities and all of that, but is there something, you know, kind of evil about the forces that are at work at the moment pushing us in this direction? Because in the end, it's anti-life in a way, but it's anti-human, isn't it?
Yeah, very much. I think that once we've abandoned all of the principles that made our civilization flourish, we are essentially at war with the very things that made us function as a cohesive people that was able to actually engineer progress. In some ways, we're living off of the momentum of earlier generations while destroying every single aspect of what made our civilization flourish at one point.
When we started this chat, I mentioned you taking a 2-year writing marathon, doing your deepest deep dive. I'm interested in that. Why do you just suddenly decide to, I need to write another book. I can't sit here at home and do it. I need to go somewhere. And then when you do your deepest deep dive, you're going to have to be connected to information for that. So I take it you were still connected to the world.
Oh, yes.
So tell us about that process. Interested to hear about that.
Yeah, it started out with the idea that, like, I wanted to write a piece, whether an article or possibly something a little bigger, to try to explain some of these forces that end up unraveling a civilization, this process of you know, centralization, and what leads society to adopt that appetite for something that the founding fathers explicitly warned against. And then in that process, so I decided that I would just take a break and not get, you know, involve myself in all of the social media and things like that, just to be able to focus on that. And then, of course, the wildfires started up here last summer, where we had a couple of cities right close to us have a fire come right sweeping through some of the neighborhoods. And of course, the climate hysteria went into full overdrive. And I decided I was going to put out a short article to deal with some of the baloney, right? And that quickly morphed into something bigger. And then that lens became the perfect explanation for what I'd originally been working on, which is this idea of why things fall apart, essentially. And so that then turned into this monstrous deep dive of just kind of going, okay, let's pull out all the stops, pull out every single layer, and let's see what happens. Just expose it all. And there's so many interesting stories that kind of bubble up that you can't see in isolation. But once you put all those layers together, very interesting insights start to emerge. It's kind of the old saying about the blind men and the elephant, where each person has one is holding the tail and explaining the elephant through that, and the next one through the ear or the leg. But it's only when you put all those pieces together that you see something, and that there's more to it than just the sum of the parts.
You would have suspected a lot of that going in.
Very much so.
But the picture, what, becomes a lot clearer?
Very much so. I think one of the biggest surprises for me was, because in each case, you're pulling on a thread that you either know is a half-truth or a cartoonish oversimplification. But there's one loose thread, which was the idea that CO2 is 78% caused by the burning of fossil fuels. And yet during COVID, the world shut down for lockdowns, right? So you have this massive reduction in the amount of fossil fuels that were burned. And it was NASA itself that actually shone a light on this. They were commenting about how they were extremely surprised to see that CO2 continued to rise at the exact same rate. Now, that isn't what's supposed to happen if there's a cut and dry case of cause and effect. And I think that launched me into a geologic deep dive or detective story it was absolutely fun to pull it out. And it was full of surprises for me as well.
Did anyone try and explain that, on the climate crisis side? Was there an explanation for, or was it like, oh, we just won't talk about that?
Yeah, I haven't seen any other explanations come from that. And maybe I missed what they came up with, but to me, it looked like it was just kind of a side note and then moved on.
Don't they call that the quiet part out loud?
Yeah, very much so. Well, I mean, this is what I find so, it is amusing as you dig through all of these research papers, is that most of the scientists that are doing this, there's a lot of really good data that's coming out. But in each case, it gets kind of swept under the rug. It doesn't make it into the press announcements by the big institutions or the IPCC. And so the information is right there. I mean, every single thing that I pulled out in my book is fully referenced, and there's a research paper peer-reviewed behind all of it. And yet you can even see often when they report on some finding that is contradictory to the narrative, you can almost hear them begging for their jobs, where they say, this does make us have to reflect if it's there's more to the story, but it doesn't, contradict the overall CO2 narrative or some version of that, right? And so they're very carefully trying to point out, like, hey, guys, we got to look at this. And at the same time, please don't hurt me.
And I hope they don't notice too much. If there's a collapse of civilization, will it be Western civilization? Because there are other parts of the world that are either too poor, not inclined to think this way, culturally different. Is this a Western civilization problem, or is it a global civilization problem? Way you see it?
Well, I think it is very much so a Western civilization problem, where all Western civilization is sort of built on these classical liberal principles, and all of those have been hollowed out and turned into parodies of themselves. And so I think it's the West that is imploding. And of course, there are other countries that are so deeply tied in that they're being pulled in as well. But I also see that a lot of countries are starting to try to distance themselves in various ways from this chaotic mess that we've got going.
Do you think the COVID experience will get people thinking seriously about the contradictions that are so obvious? They're telling us this about climate, but they told us this about COVID. None of that rang true. It's taken years for that to emerge. But do you think there's anything in the COVID experience that will help the waking up process of the masses on these other matters?
Very much so. I think that, as you say, that people are willing to have a closer look at assumptions that they would have never dared rattle on before. I mean, I can tell in my own life that there's many things that I'm willing to have a second look at that I thought were settled and done and behind us. But I think the other thing too is that, you know, as this has progressed, it's made a lot of people that are previously never ever talked to each other because they're kind of in their own separate echo chambers, that as we come together, there's so many interesting truths that have boiled to the surface that it is in some ways slowly dissolving these previous political tribes left and right, all this stuff. It doesn't actually hold very much water anymore as we start to talk to each other.
And as the attitude of the mainstream media, kind of the canary in the coal mine, if they start pushing back or reporting in a different way, because they've been all in, I think it's fair to say, on climate and COVID at the time, yeah. But we know that, you know, the checks are being written and they're probably being written for climate as well. Will that be a sign, you know, if there's any sort of directional change in mainstream media? We talk about the media's influence here a lot, so I think it's a, you know, valid question.
I think they'll probably be the last to change, but that'll be, like you say, the sign that the tide is finally turned, because they don't want they're not going to want to be completely left out in the cold, and they are losing any sense of being able to support themselves from viewership as their presence in the media space collapses.
Yeah, which is it's doing. You reminded me of another song, "The Tide Is Turning," Pink Floyd. Here you go. Book is out on Amazon, Plunderers of the Earth, The Erosion of Civilization, Mad Crusade, Control the Climate. What sort of response have you had, Julius? What's it been like?
It's been fantastic. I mean, it's kind of a scary topic to put out, to have, to rattle on so many of these assumptions. And yet the response so far has been super positive. I've been really thrilled.
So the two-year writing marathon has paid off in that respect.
Yeah.
Not wasted, right?
No, that's the thing. And it was something that was gnawing at me to be able to explain all of these things. And, to pick at it through just individual parts, it's fun as well. But there's so many parts of the story that you really have to dig much deeper and put multiple pieces together, that it's very hard to do that just through articles alone, because it requires a much like, there's so many different parts that have to be made visible at the same time.
What do you do next then? How do you top that?
Well, I've got a whole stack of articles that have been that I've been wanting to write, that, like, the topic has been sitting there burning a hole in my pocket that I can finally get to now. So I'm looking forward to being able to get back into a regular article writing routine.
You can find Julius on Substack and on X and JuliusRuchel.com. Been really interesting speaking with you, Julius. Thanks for giving us a bit of time. All the best with your book. Try and grab a copy at some point. Our listeners will respond to this with texts and emails and feedback. And we might even forward a few. That might help. I don't know. Let's see how we go. But yeah, really appreciate the chat. And hope maybe talk again some other time. All right.
You bet. That'd be my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.